Chapter 4. Where Past and Present Meet. They called themselves the Black Templars. I learned this and so much more with that first taste of brain flesh. How much ink has been committed to parchment in detailing the myriad warlike uses of Legiones Astartes enhancements? So much is made of our capacity for perfect recall, of saliva glands that produce hydrochloric acid, the imperviousness of our reinforced bones and the might of our layered muscle and sinew. Far less is spoken of the biological gift that turns cannibalism from heathen ritual into revelation. The gene seed organ responsible for this gift is the omophagia, called, in the oldest scrolls, the eighth step of supremacy, or the remembrancer. It takes root within our bodies, attaching to the brain and nervous system through fusion to the spinal column and digestive tract. Though we are gene-forged to steal sustenance from almost any organic matter, even the flesh of our fallen enemies, it's through the omophagia that we also devour our foes' memories. Nerve clusters in our stomachs carry pulses from the digesting meat to our minds, which the post-human brain interprets as instinct and insight. A beast's flesh transfers its awareness of its existence, of its surroundings, its struggles, its hungers and its dangers. You sense the nearness of its predators and the taste of its prey. A human's eyes show a blighted palette of 1,000 images over the course of the person's life, including that soul's very last sight. The brain makes for the finest meal. It offers unparalleled insight from a gallery of stolen emotion and memory. You see another being's memories as if they were your own. Unreliable, often hazy, occasionally excruciatingly vivid. Their instincts overlay yours. Your emotion and reason entwines with those of a life you never led. It takes discipline to suppress the narcotic qualities of this merging. The sensation can become an addiction all too easily, for it offers pleasure as well as power. In the Thousand Suns, we had couched the act in ritual and solemnity, praising the warrior-scholar virtue of knowing your enemy, and quelling any guilty pleasure in the cannibalistic act. Of course, such feasts of flesh are hardly uncommon when any warband emerges victorious over another. Look even to the Imperium's own record of supposedly loyal chapters, especially those of the Blood Angels Legion's genetic descent. Flesh-eaters. Blood-drinkers. How do bands of warriors earn such names, I wonder? But I'm getting ahead of myself. Those were names still many years in the future from the night aboard the shattered warship. That night, my senses swam with the reflected shards of another life. I run through a forest cooled by the dapples of shade beneath the high sun. The rock in my fist is reddened with the dark blood that bleeds from a broken skull. I stare up at the stars from where I lie in the long grass, and I wonder, where is Terra? Which star warms the Emperor's throne world? I stand before a warrior taller than any other I have ever seen. He tells me that I am chosen, that I am to come with him. The blade of my bronze knife breaks against his armor plating. I scrape my fingernails bloody as I fight. He tells me this is good. He tells me that he chose right. I sit within a stone chamber where the walls and floor and even the air is as cold as ice. I speak words of mumbled reverence as I brush sacred oils upon the teeth of an unpowered chainsword. I perform this rite with my bare fingertips, adding the blood from my cuts to the unguents. I rise from my restraint throne as light blasts into the drop pod. My bolter kicks in my hands, roaring at the inhuman creatures that throw themselves against us. Their chitinous hides burst apart beneath each impacting shell. Impure gore streaks me, streaks all of us, painting our armor with foul flesh, staining our tabards. I am shouting as I kill, and the words are like sunlight and life, and the adrenal thunder of blood running hot in battle. The words embody me, my brothers, and the heroes we strive to emulate. The words are everything. No pity, no remorse, no fear. I kneel before my marshal, lowering my head to the hilt of my downturned sword. I breathe in the dusky scent of myrrh from the smoking incense braziers, and I speak my vows of loyalty, of virtue, of courage, of zeal. The chaplain walks before us, leading the chanted chorus. I feel his eyes upon me, watchful for flaws in my demeanour, listening for any whisper of insincerity. He will find no flaws and hear no lies. I am worthy of this honour. I will not fail my brothers. I will not fail my Lord Dawn. I will not fail High Marshal Sigismund. I will not fail the immortal Emperor. I stand before my arming thralls within my private sanctum. Armor, drills, wine, and loctite inside the sockets already surgically gouged into my flesh. I am dressed in ceramite, weighted by it, rendered complete by its sacred burden. My sword is pressed into my left hand and chained in place, inviolately bound to my forearm. Around me the serfs chant my name in monastic baritone. I stand on the bridge, arrayed with my brethren before Marshal Averthus's throne. We stare into the tainted void ahead, where reality puckers and ruptures in the grip of unreal forces. This is the prison into which our ancestors cast our traitorous forebears. We stand before the very mouth of hell. I fight in the collapsing corridors of a dying ship. My weapons are sundered, my armor is broken, my body reduced to red ruin. Creatures, demons, they are demons, they can only be demons, claw at me, bearing me down, pulling me apart while I still draw blood-tasting breath. No pity. Teeth fastened to the flesh of my face, biting in, grinding down, straining, scraping, cracking. No remorse. I push the cleaved remnants of my sword up into quivering, fatty flesh. No fear. I was myself once more, metabolizing the stolen memories. Telemachon and Amuriel indulged their curiosities as well. I could see them working through the ingested lives, trawling through the recollections for slivers of deeper insight. Telemachon was helmed, of course, but I could see Amuriel's features ticking with involuntary muscle responses to the emotions and traumas of the dead Black Templar's long life.
Angevin, he said. The warrior's name was Angevin.
I had felt the same sense of identity when I first tasted the memories.
They came into the eye willingly, he added, scouting and exploring.
Hunting, Telemachon amended. Hunting us. We have to warn Ezekiel. I had not intended to speak those words, but now they were spoken, the truth of them bit deep. If these Templars stand vigil outside the eye, it may change everything. Telemachon shook his head.
No matter how many of them are waiting for us, no matter if they meet us with every warship in the Imperial Fist's fleet, they won't have enough iron in the void to stop us breaking free.
Perhaps not, I conceded. But they would have enough to leave us deeply scarred. Do you believe Abaddon wishes to lose hundreds, even thousands, of the warriors we have so painstakingly recruited?
To say nothing of the casualties we'll sustain when Ashokai guides us out of the eye,
Amuriel warned. This too was true. No few warbands had lost vessels in the desperate storms that raged at the eye's edge. Our prison was viciously adept at keeping us caged.
If we emerge piecemeal in the face of an enemy fleet.
Amuriel let the words hang.
Guesswork, Telemachon replied smoothly.
Preparation and consideration, I replied.
Kaon,
a voice breathed, and my spine tightened. Amuriel spoke up, supporting my words. I was not entirely certain of the specifics of what he said. Telemachon replied. I do not know what he said either. The voice I was hearing belonged to neither of them.
Kaon.
Nagual padded closer, claws scratching the deck. He bared his fangs in a slow growl.
Who calls, master?
I do not know. Telemachon and Amuriel were still conversing, the former doing so while he took blood and flesh samples from the fallen Templar, the latter speaking while examining a compact but blocky pattern of bolt pistol I had not seen before.
Kaon.
I rose slowly, looking towards the archway mouth of the western corridor. The crash had broken this portion of the ship, leaving the deck sloped, leading down into yet more powerless dark.
Kaon.
I heard Telemachon's armor purr as he turned to me.
What ails you, assassin?
I did not turn to look at him. Someone is here. I heard the echolocation clicks as Amuriel reactivated his Auspex. I felt Telemachon staring at me, though he remained silent.
Nothing,
Amuriel confirmed.
Kaon.
I sense a presence, I said, nearby. Within the city, or whatever the closest settlement is called. It knows my name.
Male? Female?
Amuriel asked.
Is it even human?
I cannot tell. It is less than a whisper. And this was so. If you can imagine the impression of lips moving, mouthing your name without breath to give sound to a voice.
You're a miserable alien?
Amuriel snorted the question.
She has no psychic capability, Telemachon answered before I could, and his rich voice carried a seedy reverence that made my skin crawl. Her soul is far too delicate.
It is not Nefertari, I said. Whoever it is, I am not even certain they are alive. This is a world of mournful echoes and unquiet ghosts.
Then ignore it, was the swordsman's suggestion.
Kaon, Kaon, Kaon.
I could not ignore this. For someone or something to gain access to my mind, even to brush my surface thoughts like this, spoke of a being with considerable power and significant intent. Trap or not, I was going to find the answer to this mystery. I reached after it, finding nothing but mist, mist, mist. It is coming from deeper in the ship. Or no, from beneath the ship. I looked to Amuriel. Are there any subterranean fortresses nearby? The former Sons of Horus legionary took a moment to answer, and his aura flared with uneasy light. Something in my words had discomforted him.
Several.
Amuriel's eyes met mine. He wiped the smeared evidence of his investigative cannibalism from his mouth. One of his legionaries clarified.
Lord Kaon, the warrior said, the Monumentum Primus is only 30 kilometers from here.
I hesitated. That possibility had simply not occurred to me.
We are near the Tomb of Horus.
Yes, Lord Kaon.
Kaon.
The presence was a needling caress inside my skull.
Kaon, Kaon, Kaon.
I clenched my teeth against its unwelcomely tantalizing touch. I rose to my feet.
Show me the way.
The ship had fused with the earth, amalgamating with the fortress complexes beneath the surface. Here was another world entirely, a realm of fallout bunkers, interconnected trench mazes and subterranean chambers. The Black Templar's strike cruiser had speared into the ground and swiftly found its wreckage bound in the mutated grip of the realm below. Everywhere I looked, corrosion was rife, the decay of the world above creeping down here in infections of rot and rust. Power lapses plunged whole portions of the complexes into darkness, and what light remained was strained and weak, flickering on the edge of failure. The truth of Malium was just as ugly as the lie, for soon enough we were walking through chambers and corridors littered with industrial detritus and the half-eaten bodies of slain humans, beastmen, and legionaries alike. Most of the dead legion warriors wore the armor of the Sons of Horus, left to rot where they lay. The purple and puce of the Emperor's children was also in evidence, along with shades marking resting places of fighters drawn from the other legions. Most of these bodies had been gouged open by fleshsmiths and apothecaries, their progenoids harvested in the heat of battles fought long ago. The charnel house smell penetrated my armor and sank into my senses. I could feel it in my pores. I could taste it, that sour meat stink on the back of my teeth. Amuriel's warrior, Dejak, led us deeper. My retinal display tracked the depth, and it wasn't long before my fragile telepathic thread to the Rubrikai aboard our gunship thinned and severed, leaving them unbound. They would fulfill their last orders, but I couldn't reach them to see through their eyes or issue them new commands. nor was I about to stop and achieve the necessary meditative focus to recommune with them. Dejak stopped at a junction, his helm panning across a long arcing bloodstain along a bolt-punctured wall. Nothing about it seemed any different to the rest of the biological mess we'd seen in the complex so far. Telemachon and I glanced at one another. "This smear of sanguine filth is notable in some way?" I asked Dejak. I suspected that Lahior would have made some irritable remark about fine Chthonian art. As much as I wished for his presence here, rather than Telemachon's, I did not miss what passed for his wit.
"It's a sigil, lords."
Dejak walked down the left-hand corridor without bothering to illuminate us as to what exactly about the blood smear informed this decision. He was with Amuriel at the head of the squad, deferring to his lord. We followed once more. Telemachon's clawed boots clicked and scraped with the percussion of each of his footfalls.
"A gang sign, I suspect," his mellifluous voice murmured over the vox to me alone. "A marking of territory. An echo of what once was on now-dead Chthonia."
"Most likely." I was not certain where this conversational gambit was going, but I knew Telemachon, and I knew it was leading somewhere.
"Lexandru,"
he purred my name with the gothic twist of his former homeworld. "Tell me," he added, beneficent and smooth,
"of Drol Kir."
Bolters crashing in arrhythmic percussion, energized blades thunderclapping against burning warplate, blood running hot, steaming in the cold, marshy air, life becoming vapor, red smoke curling from riven ceramite. "Well, there is little to say."
"And yet," said Telemachon, "so many of our cousins among the legions do have something to say. And they all say the same thing."
"Iskandar Kaon died at Drol Kir." "It was a battle," I replied. "A vast one, but not a glorious one."
"How so?"
"Why does this matter?" His fascination was unjustified. Several warbands from various legions had banded together against several others and waged war across the ever-shifting ground of a demon world, warring for territory. What else was there to say? Battles of that kind took place every hour of every day, somewhere within eye space. Drol Kir was unremarkable beyond the immense casualties sustained when the Death Guard had rained alchemical toxins upon their allies and enemies alike.
"But," Telemachon pressed, "whose side were you on?"
I was scarcely listening to his irrelevant purring. Something on his armor drew my eye. "Hold," I commanded. He turned back to me, his impassive, beautiful silver faceplate meeting my gaze and targeting locks. I tore Telemachon's sidearm free of its leather holster, pulling it into my hand with a drag of telekinesis. I turned the ornate bolt pistol in my fist, looking at the curious decoration hanging from the polished gold grip. Tokens and charms were common on our weapons and armor, but I'd never seen him with this keepsake before. A feather. A single black feather. I tore it from the fine golden chain that bound it to the pistol grip and crushed it in my hand. "Is this from her wings?" I demanded.
"But of course."
"You diseased creature. Stalking her. Watching her.
And more."
The onyx of his eyes flashed with reflected light. Telemachon was smiling. His face mask didn't change, but I sensed whatever was left of his face behind the silver twisting in mirth. I ground the remnants of the feather beneath my boot. In the same moment, Naguel ghosted silently from the shadows behind Telemachon, his muscles bunching with the urge to leap. "No," I said to my lynx.
"I will end him."
My mind inferred the tigress lynx's violent eagerness as words, though as ever no words were spoken. His jaws parted slowly, readying volcanic glass saber teeth the length of swords. "No, Naguel." His thoughts curdled, becoming a fusion of expectant sensation. The rending of ceramite beneath unbreakable claws, the hot rush of human blood upon the tongue. "Naguel!" I sent the command as a blade to break through the beast's closing mind. "Obey!" He heeded me, but only just. Only because he had to, lest he risk my displeasure. I missed my wolf,
lost to Horus Reborn all those years before. Where Nagual had hunger, Gaia had possessed intelligence. Where Gaia was a gifted huntress, Nagual was a ravening destroyer. He had his uses, but I was increasingly certain that I would banish him soon, just as I'd banished every other failed successor to the wolf I still mourned. All of this transpired in the merest of moments. I looked from my lynx to Telemachon, and the words I spoke were not the ones I'd intended to speak. "Do you value your life so little?" I asked him, surprising myself with my own honesty. "This hunger for her will be the death of you." The swordsman tilted his head, regarding me through his backlit eye lenses.
"Oh, is that concern I hear in your voice, Lexandru? Can it be that you fear for my well-being?"
Loyalty to Ezekiel's vision had so far prevented our mutual distrust from becoming disgust. We had sworn to be brothers and never to harm one another, an oath taken at Abaddon's behest when we first carved the Legion symbols from our armour. Telemachon had stolen several artificer slaves to artfully paint his armour black. I had simply charred the paint from my own and blackened it with conjured wisps of warp fire. We were far from our lord now, but my adherence to his vision was inviolate. I believed in Abaddon's ambitions. I would not break with his trust. I tossed the pistol back to Telemachon. "The same rules that govern you and me do not apply to Nefertari," I pointed out. "If you continue to antagonize her, she will kill you, regardless of our oath."
"And you fear bearing the blame for her actions?"
Damn him, I could hear the smile in his voice.
"Ah, no, it isn't that. What you fear is far more territorial. It makes your skin crawl, doesn't it? The chance she may come to treasure my attentions. You fear that the youngest god looks through my eyes, seeking to swallow her soul."
I stared at him, at the argent and flawless face he presented to brother and foe alike. Words eluded me for several seconds. How was one supposed to react to such baiting? "Spare me the deluded twists of your broken mind," I said. "I do not interfere with the preening, wailing things you call minions. Do not meddle with my coterie either."
"As you wish, Lexandru," he replied smoothly.
He reached to run his fingers through Nagual's striped grey-black fur, but the demon gave a throaty warning snarl. Telemachon pulled his hand back.
"I see,"
the swordsman said, perfectly calm. I could feel him smiling again. Amuriel was watching us, as were his warriors. The servos in Amuriel's neck snarled as he shook his head.
"If you're finished, brothers!"
Chastened, I fell in behind him once more. Greasy amusement still radiated from Telemachon's aura. I felt it as an itch against my skin, impossible to ignore. Part of my irritation was that he'd spoken the plain truth. If he baited Nefertari into crossing blades with him, the blame would fall on my shoulders for not controlling her. Abaddon tolerated her only because I made it clear I wouldn't cast her aside. She was too useful to me. I wouldn't let myself consider Telemachon's other insinuations. His sick craving for her was born of his hunger for sensation, any sensation at all, and the god that flowed in his bloodstream cried out to devour Nefertari's Eldar soul. Being near to her caused him pain. Even the slow creep of agony she caused him electrified his nerves with pleasure. "Wretched parasite," I thought.
"Master,"
my simple-minded familiar's senses met mine. "Not you, Nagual."
"The faceless man."
How many times had I imprinted Telemachon's name upon what passed for Nagual's mind? Each attempt was an exercise in futility. "Yes, the faceless man." The faceless man. How apt. To his own men, the warriors of the shrieking masquerade, Telemachon was most often called the Masked Prince. I preferred Nagual's title.
"I will end him,"
the great cat promised me. Flicker-flash sensations hissed through my thoughts. The salty heat of running blood, the useless thrashing of prey with my jaws locked around its throat. "No, Nagual."
"Breathe the command, and it will be done."
As tempting as it was, I did nothing of the kind. The first chamber of worth we reached was among the more tragic sights I have ever witnessed. Deep within the complex, a Muriel led us into an apothecarium that far exceeded any military Medicaid centre in both grandeur and purpose. Colossal vault tanks rose like fortress walls, all instrumentation and console circuitry pulled apart and riven by chain blades. The archive banks, where priceless genetic material had been held in stasis-locked storage, were looted and destroyed in deliberate spite, rather than by the incidental damage of war. Every container that had once held vital chemical cocktails of preservative fluids was smashed and dry, now home to hives of insect vermin, making their lairs in machines that had once granted transhuman life. A gene seed repository. I recognized the place's purpose as soon as I saw it. The importance of these hallowed halls is burned into the very marrow of every Legion warrior. Telemachon similarly needed no elucidation. He laughed softly upon entering, the sound slow and wet, and entirely sincere at the devastation of this priceless place. A Muriel had been Medicae Quintus within the Sons of Horus, a ranking officer by any judgment. He walked through the chamber as if in the grip of a dream, no doubt seeing the shades of what had once been overlaying the truth of what was. He examined shattered machinery and useless tools, saying nothing as he explored. "Was this your laboratory?" I asked him.
"No. Mine was always aboard the Viridian Sky. The warriors of my company never risked storing our gene seed reserves on Melium, even before the Emperor's children came for the War Master's corpse."
Something occurred to me then that hadn't before. When the children of the Emperor raided this world and defiled Horus's corpse for use in their bastardized cloning foundries, they surely wouldn't have resisted plundering the 16th Legion's gene seed depositories. Twice the insult, twice the desecration.
"There's nothing here,"
Amuriel declared.
"Let's go."
Nagual was busy, breathing corrosive smoke into a colony of slug-like creatures that crackled and popped as they dissolved. He licked the resulting sludge up with one swipe of his tongue, swallowing noisily. "To me," I said. The lynx obeyed, his eyes glowing with the absorption of more demonic matter. We walked on through the rusted dark. And to think I'd been concerned about playing ambassador on Melium. We were not emissaries. We were practically thieves. Thieves in a realm where everything of worth had already been stolen. A journey that should have taken us no time at all instead took over a week in the time-lost way one judges such things in the eye. So many of the tunnels had mutated closed or fallen into ruin, we found ourselves constantly doubling back and seeking alternate routes. Added to that, the labyrinthine complexes beneath the earth shifted when you dared take your eyes from the passage ahead, leading in conflicting directions again and again. Truly, the warp had riddled its way through the stone of this world's core and twisted the planet to its indiscernible whims. And all the while, "Kaon, Kaon," echoed in my skull, never louder, never quieter, never weaker, never stronger, just there. Our armor sustained us, feeding nutrients back into our systems and infusing us with synthesized chemical feeds to maintain alertness and health over protracted deployment. The leathery flesh of the dead, even their bones, would offer us sustenance if we chose to indulge, but we were a far cry from starvation. Telemachon sampled those cold delicacies purely out of choice. I made no comment each time I saw him removing the lower half of his faceplate to do so. Eating the unburied dead was something most of us had done in times of desperation, and there was no denying that necessity had become preference among many warbands banished to the eye. By Imperial standards, such feasts are the least of our sins. I learned that the entirety of Melium was connected beneath the surface, with freeholds and subterranean fortresses linked by tunnels and trenches.
The deeper we moved, the more evidence pointed to abandonment rather than annihilation. Signs of conflict lessened, replaced by signs of desolation. The bodies we found had expired from hunger or thirst, as often as those torn open by raiders' weapons. The Emperor's children hadn't penetrated to the deepest levels in huge numbers. When they had passed this far, it was as slavers and plunderers, eager to get their spoils back to the surface. Thus, they had sacrificed an invader's thoroughness for a pirate's prudence. Even some of the armories weren't looted fully, though the weapons we found there were in various states of dysfunction. One of the wonders we discovered in the depths was a great transit route, powered down and empty now, with an underground conveyor rail tunnel between one fortress and another. The mutants that thrived down there in the lightless deeps prayed to the powerless rail engines as iron gods, beseeching them to awaken from their slumber. I could not guess how many generations of Legion slaves and serfs had interbred under the Eye's influence to produce these sorry creatures. I pitied them, though more for their uselessness and ignorance than from any sympathy. Amuriel and the others ignored them. Telemachon found them delightful, hunting them the way a beast would hunt herds of weaker prey. He laughed joyously as he raced away into the darkness, returning later with blood spatters drying across his armour. Nagual ached to give chase to them as well. I allowed it each time, if only to distract my lynx from pulsing his hungry insistence that he would kill Telemachon if I but asked. I wondered if Nefertari, alone on the surface all this time, had found similar prey. Amuriel focused only on the gene seed depositories. He didn't hold much hope of locating actual genetic material, knowing that all of it would have been destroyed or long since rotted within failed preservative machinery. Instead, he sought to rekindle what systems he could bring back to a semblance of life, seeking data above all. He worked with his customary focus, draining wounded data archives of any lore they could be coaxed into surrendering. I was tempted to ask if he was delaying our journey, taking these alternate routes to rifle through old apothecarians.
Kaon,
the voice caressed the inside of my skull, a constant whisper against the back of my eyes.
Kaon, Kaon, Kaon.
What are you doing?
I snapped at Amuriel at one point.
Compiling a monograph,
he said, as he watched an information feed inloading into his Narthesium storage coils.
A treatise on every aspect of the Legion's gene seed. This is a rare opportunity. I want every word ever written about the process, from basic schema and flawed experimentation, all the way through to stable modification.
We can already maintain what we have, said Telemachon.
Barely,
Amuriel replied, without looking up from his Vambrace console.
Our numbers won't fall if we're diligent.
Amuriel still didn't look up.
They will over time, whether we're diligent or not. But this isn't only about the gene seed supplies we already have.
Names, I said, interrupting their burgeoning disagreement.
Ezekiel is not only gathering gene seed data, he's gathering names. The name of every son of Horus entered into the Legion's archives as confirmed dead.
This was typical of Abaddon's precision. He was compiling an archive of who still lived, tallying the fallen and survivors alike. It was the best way of knowing what percentage of the remaining Legion was already sworn to us, sailing as part of our fleet. The rest would be hunted down and recruited, or killed. Amuriel's nod told me that I had assumed correctly.
I was made for greater deeds than administrative archiving, said Telemachon. Be swift. This place bores me.
It took another 2 days to reach the tomb of Horus. The sarcophagus was empty. Where once Horus had lain in state, arms crossed over his chest, hands gripping the hilt of Worldbreaker, there now stood a great coffin of empty cracked marble. Its proportions were appropriately massive, only making its emptiness more pitiable. The gold leaf inscriptions were gone, broken by boots and hammers. Towering windows of stained glass, once backlit in this subterranean sanctuary, were holes in the high walls, while the scenes of glory and rebellion they had once depicted
were reduced to diamond rubble that crunched beneath our boots. Skulls that had once been the trophies of innumerable conquests were particulate bone dust, swirling slowly in the stagnant air. Amuriel's men were commanded to wait. We went in alone.
Kaon.
The whisper brushed against me once more, still sourceless, still directionless. Once this fortress had been called the Monumentum Primus. Now it was a ruined castle deep within Malium's crust, shaped from slave-hewn rock and the eroding bones of monstrous warp serpents. I've been in places that stank of tawdry, useless prayer, and I have walked worlds where I was the only living being. Yet no fane or cathedral ever felt so crass as that crypt, and no prison or place of lonely pilgrimage ever felt as desolate. I was not sure whom I despised more, those that had prayed here as fools kneel before an altar, or those that had defiled this tomb out of blasphemous ambition. The crypt was lifeless, but far from empty. Wraiths gathered here in worship, ethereal and near silent. Here were the shades of kneeling beastmen, their avian crying and bestial braying stolen by time, rendered down to breathy impressions of the sounds once made by living throats. Here were warriors in the viridian battle plate of the sons of Horus, standing in austere reflection or dueling over their father's bones. Here were invading emperor's children, laughing, killing, executing. Hordes of fighting warriors, hosts of worshippers, moments in time overlapping, conjured by the spiritual significance of this hallowed ground.
Iskander,
Amuriel said, low and solemn.
If you would.
I nodded. With a gesture of my hand, I banished the unquiet dead, pushing the manifest energy from this vast chamber. It was like scattering a handful of sand to the wind. Devoid of those echoes, the chamber grew truly silent. Alone now, we approached the sarcophagus. The body this coffin had cradled was years gone. First hauled away like a hunter's kill, to be dissected on the unclean slabs of Third Legion butcher surgeons, then recovered by Abaddon and the very first of his Ezekarian after the destruction of Horus Reborn. What remained of the War Master's corpse, the genetic plunder that was all Fabius Bile had left intact from the looted cadaver, was housed safely within the Apothecarian Apex aboard the Vengeful Spirit, stasis sealed and guarded by 100 of our Syntagma war robots, linked to the Anamnesis's conscious control. You might think, ignorantly but not unfairly, that Horus's genetic samples alone would be enough for us to engineer an endless supply of the 19 biosynthetic organs necessary for implantation to create space marines from human boy children. Now, this is not so, no matter any individual apothecary's genius. The Emperor himself envisioned the process, which speaks to the intellect required to first bring it into being and put it into effect with the immense technological impetus of the throne world and its unprecedented access to relics of the Dark Age. Even now, in the Imperium, an Adeptus Astartes chapter can be rendered slowly extinct by the theft of its gene seed, despite its Medicae warriors possessing all the information and support necessary to re-engineer new progenoid glands and create new space marines. Indeed, such defilement is one of the 9 Legion's preferred punishments. Nothing drives a chapter to such desperation, nor tars them with such shame, as the theft of their future. And as for the Legions themselves? Would we raid our thin-blooded cousins and descendants in the Imperium if we could render new gene-seed organs with ease? Would we slaughter each other over fragments of lore or tithe fortunes in service and materiel to the Mechanicum's demon forges if we could simply engineer miracles without their priceless expertise? We bind demons into our war machines to keep them functioning. We forge new amalgamated horrors of demonic flesh and cold metal to replace technology we can no longer maintain. Remember this, For context is precious in the comprehension of this tale. For all that we mock the Imperium in the way you make a virtue of small-minded ignorance, we too have lost so very much. Perhaps even more. Your masters have sealed knowledge away from you, incinerated it, or it has been lost through the natural passage of time. We, on the other hand, have watched it slip through our fingers, even when we try to keep it close. Nowhere exemplified this better than the shameful crypt on Melium. One of the ghosts refused to disperse. It watched the three of us approaching, turning old, old eyes to each of us in turn. I felt the fall of its judging gaze upon me like a threat, a blade stroking against my armour. How long had it been here? Had it always been here? Even when this sepulchre had been inhabited by the War Master's deluded sons, only taking shape in the vacuum left by their absence. The spirit was human, though its soul was boiling with the memories and emotions of accumulated centuries. Whoever it had been in life, it had witnessed sights and lived an existence far in excess of those allotted to a typical mortal span. Its form, that which we call a corpus when speaking of warp-born entities, was stable and unchanging. Its long hair was dark and ragged. Its skin, much like mine, was the dusky melange common among civilizations that rise in the equatorial regions of worlds like Terra. It wore a traveller's cloak of faded black and simple travel-worn clothing. Tears stained its cheeks, tears of white ink. Those four trails of sorrow were tattoos of tiny scripture from the corners of its eyes. It was, or had been in life, an unmutated human female. I reached for the warp ghost a dozen metres away, fingers curled as if to crush its throat with telekinesis. The air whirled with an unseen breeze in answer to the energy I summoned. The spirit's hair trailed in the breeze. Telemachon hesitated in his approach. I heard the fibre bundle cords in his armoured collar purr as he tilted his head. A Muriel halted a half-step after, looking between the apparition and the scanner display on his Narthesium gauntlet. At my side, Naguel watched the spectre with glowing eyes, his jaws parted. Venom dripped from his sabre teeth.
"Kaon,"
came the whisper one last time, and the ghost smiled.
"Iskandar Kaon,"
said the wraith, its voice completely human.
"Telemachon Lyras and Amuriel Enka."
I lowered my hand. The rising wind died. The three of us said nothing, confronted suddenly by a human woman where no living being had any right to be.
"You will take me to Ezekiel Abaddon."
She said it not as a command, but as if she were speaking of a memory that hadn't yet happened. "And why will we do that?" I asked.
"Because I bring him a warning,"
she replied, perfectly calm.
"And I will deliver him a future."
Amuriel and Telemachon merely stared at her. I was the one to ask the question on our tongues. "Who are you?" She told us. She gave us a single name, though others would grant her many more titles across the years to come. And that was how I met Moriana, the Weeping Maiden, Oracle of the Despoiler, Prophetess of the Black Legion.